So tonight's speaker is Chasten, and he's going to do awesome, mostly because he's just awesome. So with that, I give you Chasten.
My name is Chasten. I'm a drug addict, and it's good to be here. Brandon asked me to do this a little ways out, and I'll be honest, I didn't really think too much about it. We have a lot going on at home, and about 2 days ago, it actually started creeping up on me. And every time I get a chance to do this, I get an opportunity to really reflect on my life and where I've been and what this process has been for me, and the experiences that I've had, which have been absolutely tremendous. Little housekeeping to get us started. Like I said earlier, I'm a sobriety. It's March 16th, 2016. I have a sponsor, and he knows he's my sponsor because I use him. I have a home group, Usual Suspects meeting, Cocaine Anonymous. We meet on Wednesdays, 7 to 8. I'm the treasurer of that meeting. I sponsor men. They sponsor men. I'm an active participant in this program. And I know that I can say that today. And that hasn't always been the case. For the past 8 years, my involvement in the program has waxed and waned. And maybe tonight, the meeting's called Sharing the Gift, and that's really what I want to talk about tonight. And the thing that's been on my mind most recently is the past 2 days while thinking about this stuff, is just the process of recreating my life and the power that's done that. I grew up in Augusta, Georgia. I had a beautiful childhood, and it's so weird because every year I look back on the way that I was raised and all the opportunities that I was afforded, and every year it gets better. And maybe that's because I've transitioned into different roles as a husband, as a father, as a contributing member of society. And I start to look back on my life and think about how amazing my childhood was. But like a lot of us, I had a feeling like I just didn't fit, like I got dropped off here, and I only had a couple chapters of a book that everybody else had the whole thing, and I didn't understand why. I didn't understand why I was consumed with how everybody else thought about me or what their perception of me was, and all of that was created up here, and I started that from a very young age. I was popular in school. I had friends, and part of that is now I know today that there's a part of me that can mold and adapt and be whatever you need me to be whenever I need to be it. I found purpose in doing things like playing sports and having girlfriends and doing all of that stuff. And around the time that I was in seventh grade, I went on a cruise with one of my best friends. And I remember sitting in the hallway, and you remember on cruises where you would, if you ever went on a cruise, we would sneak alcohol in there, and we would take these like Gatorade bottles, and we would fill them up, or shampoo bottles, and we'd fill them up with that cheap vodka, and we would sneak that on. And I remember somewhere in between a Gatorade bottle full of vodka, somewhere between the top and the bottom of it, it happened for me. I remember feeling like the world and everything was right with itself, and I could just breathe this huge sigh of relief. I remember feeling like I could go talk to all the girls, and I could fight, and I was funny. And I went out on the course of that night, And in my mind, I did all of those things. But the truth is that what happened that night was my buddies dragged me around by my elbows, and I proceeded to get alcohol poisoning and had to be taken to the cruise infirmary. And that's kind of how I drank. That was my experience. And when I don't even remember, that was the last day on the cruise. I don't even remember going back from Florida to Georgia, and they dropped me off at my dad's house and told him he probably needs a shot of penicillin, but he's going to be recovering for a day or two. And things were fun then, but it's not normal for a seventh grader to drink like that. And I continued this with really just binge drinking and stuff on the weekends. And part of my story is that I come from a long line of alcoholics, and one of the things we did when I went to stay at my dad's on the weekend, we were allowed to drink, and that was part of it. We partied, we were able to go out. My dad didn't really mind if we left, and as long as we didn't drive anywhere, and I was allowed to do that. And I truly believe that I practiced perfecting the effect that alcohol had on me. I managed to make it through high school, and I had good grades. I got in the University of Georgia. I went to college, and that was where things started to kind of take a turn, because I didn't have, the structure of my family around me, and I joined a fraternity, and I continued to embark on this kind of journey of seeing what different substances I could mix to create the desired effect. I started smoking a lot of weed. I started doing a lot of cocaine. I started experimenting with benzos, and I started blacking out. And my at this time, my father was descending into the depths of his alcoholism, and part of my experience in Athens was really shutting a lot of that out. And then in 2011, I got a call at about 2 in the morning. And it was my mom, and she was outside my house, and she said, "Baby, I need you to come outside." And I went out there, and she said, "Baby, your daddy died." And that experience for me, this was a man who was my hero, who was absolutely everything to me. And I went home, and we did the funeral, and I proceeded to grieve and tell everybody that I was going to be okay, but I was going to return to school, because I was going to handle my business. But what I did, and it wasn't too different from what happened in that hallway on the cruise ship, was that I proceeded to stay under the influence of something for damn near a year every single day. I started to get into some trouble. My grades were awful because I never went to class. I started to lose friends, and I started to dabble in some different drugs. I started doing Roxy's, and I started doing meth, and like we do, as it progresses, my mom got me into a treatment center. She somehow tricked me into going to this treatment center in Florida, and at that point in time, all I'd really done was snorted some stuff, and I got introduced to IV use through stories of people were telling at the treatment center, and I got introduced to things like heroin, and the budding addict and alcoholic that I was. I mean, I grabbed hold of it. And like thinking back on the insanity of that, right? I had, my experience when I was in Athens was was not that I was surrounded by bad people. I was surrounded by some amazingly smart people, right? And the big book describes them in the hard drinkers, right? My friends were not, were doing just as much stuff as I was. But somewhere along the line, I crossed this line, and I couldn't turn back. And these guys were, these guys are lawyers and doctors and financial executives, and some of our friends played in the NFL, and I was surrounded by these people, and I was going to be one of those people in my own mind, and the delusion behind that. And so I'm at this treatment center, and I end up going to a halfway house, and I did what we do. I stayed sober for 6 months. The halfway house was connected to an AA clubhouse, and I did the absolute bare minimum. I got a sponsor that I never used, and I proceeded to get high absolutely every single chance I would get. And this wasn't my first experience in the rooms. I had tried to do the outpatient thing. I had tried, but the needed power to actually take a hold of this thing wasn't there. And I'll fast forward, but while I was in Florida, I remember driving down the highway in Jacksonville, and I remember sticking my arm into the back seat because I didn't want to see him do it, and somebody hitting me with a shot of Dilaudid. And I remember being like, oh yes, this is what I've been waiting for. And opiates aren't even really my thing. And so, suffice it to say, I came back home eventually from that halfway house, and I spent the next 3 years in and out of treatment doing what we do. I ended up homeless. I ended up, I called it homeless. I was living out of my car. I was driving around with dope dealers and people who would hurt you, and murderers, and I think back, I was thinking back about it yesterday. Two of the guys that I used to do meth with, one of them got stabbed to death, and one of them got executed in Burke County. And those are the kinds of people that I put myself around, because I could not stand the absolute way that I felt. And if you think that's weird, it's because it is weird. I look like a banker, right? I don't look like these people. And I remember going into a dope house, and I remember a girl grabbing me and saying, "Oh, baby, you don't belong here." And I remember being like, I know I don't. From 2012 until 2015, my life consisted of going to meetings, going to treatment, not doing anything, coming back out, getting miserable again, drinking, and then getting high, over and over and over again. And that period of time, when I look back on it, I was sober for most of it. Right? Because I'd go back and I'd live with mama, and she'd say, "Chasten, you can't use in this house. You can't drink in this house because we know what happens when you drink." And I'd say, "Yes, ma'am, I know. I don't want to be homeless. I don't want to hurt everybody around me." And I would always get high. And if you can recall what it was like to be in a state where you knew you wanted to get high, but you also knew you couldn't, and trying to live in that, trying to live in that world make you want to blow your absolute brains out. I eventually took a girl hostage, Not violently. It's my wife now, but and I moved in with her, and I took her through this entire thing. This girl had never even seen anything beyond weed, and here I am shooting meth in the bathroom, faking like I'm going to work, putting on two different pairs of clothes, and I look like a scarecrow. And she's like, "What is going on?" And we did this for a while, and I don't really know how to explain what happened on about March 15th of 2016, but I woke up in a house off of Dease Avenue in Augusta. A dope house is what it was, but there were kind people there. There were people that fed me there, when I was hungry. That gave me a safe place to stay when I was kicked out of the house. And I woke up at that house, and I opened my Facebook on the computer because I had deactivated it and I had broken my phone so no one could get in touch with me. And I saw a message from my mom. And all it said was, "I love you, sweet boy." And something in me broke. There was a bunch of people in the living room, and everyone was in there doing hot rails, and one of those guys found me crying, and he said, "Man, come on, get yourself together, come in here." And I tried to do one, and nothing. I didn't feel anything. And maybe it was bad dope, but or maybe it was something else. I had a little bit of weed in a Advil bottle with some Xanax in it, and I tried to smoke some weed, and nothing. I couldn't feel anything. And I left that guy's house. And I drove to the North Augusta AA meeting, and I parked my car. I got in touch with my mom, and I said, "I need a little bit of gas. I'm just going to the AA meetings, and I'm not leaving." And she said, "Well, you can come here, and I will talk to you, but I'm not giving you any money." And so I went to my mom's office. She's a nurse, and she manages home health care systems, and I went to her office, and I went upstairs, and I looked her right in the eyes, and she said, "Chasten," she said, "I have come to terms with the fact that you are going to die out there, and I have made my peace with that." And she said, "I just don't want you to go to hell." And another part of me broke. I sat in my car at one of the AA meetings, and I had heard about this place called the Bridges of Hope, and I knew what they did there. I knew that this wasn't like the other places that I had gone to treatment. I had gone to treatment at places that have chiropractors and massage therapists and equine therapy, and they give you a lot of Suboxone, and they let you sleep, and that wasn't what this place was like, and I wasn't willing to ever go there. I actually made it a point. I said, "I will never go to this place." And I was sitting out of the clubhouse over off Camilla Avenue in Augusta, and I was sitting outside, and I said, I saw two friends walk out, two guys that I went to high school with, and I had never seen them in a meeting before. And I said, "What are y'all doing?" And they were like, "We're on paths in the bridges." Mind you, I had been living out of a black trash bag, and I had been cutting my own hair for the past 6 months, and I hadn't shaved my face. And they said, "Do you want us to call them?" And when everything in me said I didn't want them to, I said yes. And a lot of that was what it was like. And I went to the Bridges of Hope, and I could barely speak when I got there. I was so broken. And Roscoe looked at me, and we didn't even really have to talk. He just nodded his head, and he said he gave me my bunk number. And I noticed one thing about all of the people at the Bridges was that, there was something different about everybody there that I had never truly seen in a meeting before. And I don't know if it wasn't if it was because that wasn't at the meetings. I don't think that's true. I think it's because I was finally at a place where I was absolutely split wide open. Tara says that a lot, and I truly connect with that, that a part of me inside of me broke that I didn't even know could break. That I was willing to absolutely do anything on this planet as long as I didn't have to be me anymore. And I walked down to our bunks, and I walked in the bathroom, and there's a long log over all the mirrors in the bathroom with all the sinks in it, and it just says right across it says you're looking at the problem. And I knew that I didn't really know what they were going to do there. I had had absolutely zero experience working the steps. I had conned my way through a couple steps and gotten to inventory and just said, oh, screw this, I'm not doing this in the meetings. But I knew I was there, and I was there for the long haul. And so we were going to do whatever it was that was there, because I was already accepting the fact that I was going to die. I might as well try this, right? I didn't even believe. But I came to believe when I saw the guys there. My experience at the Bridges of the Hope was tremendous, and I got exposed to guys that allowed me to become conscious of my actions on a daily basis. And I learned discipline, and I worked the steps while I was there. And I would, we would have these breakout sessions, and I would listen to these tapes by guys like Chris Raymer, and I was just absolutely floored hearing people like Mark Houston and stuff. And I didn't understand that there was a deeper level of awareness and consciousness beyond what I had, but beyond the God that I knew from church. And that didn't really interest me. But what they told me there was that, you bring your own conception here, right? And now I understand that will grow, and that will develop over time. We did a lot of really good things. I stayed there for 7 months, and I had tremendous experiences while I was there, working the steps and beginning to make amends and all of these things. And then one weekend we had these guys come out there, and one of them was redheaded and kind of mean, and the other one was very soft, even though he looked like a mountain man. And that experience absolutely revolutionized everything that I thought about the way that this work is to be approached. I sat in every single one of those meetings, and I took notes. And I mean, good Lord, I turned my big book into like a coloring book that weekend. Learning about how we turn statements into questions, and hearing what they really did was they just told stories. And I couldn't wrap my brain around what it was like to have all these experiences with these steps, and I didn't even really understand them. But for probably the first time in my journey, I truly wanted what they had. And I eventually got out of that treatment center, and there was one guy who I knew I needed to ask to be my sponsor, because he was the only guy that even sounded remotely similar to what I had heard when those guys came. And I immediately got out of the bridges, and I asked him to sponsor me, and we went on this on this journey together. And you know, looking back now, I've been sober for 8 years, and I've told my story a number of times, and I can't tell you how many times, you know, my story typically ends right there, right? That's where it ends, right? Because the following 6 years of my recovery, I sponsored people, and I would write inventory. I would work the steps on a semi-regular basis, but there was no deep connection with them, with the experience that I was having currently. There was no deeper understanding. There was, and you know, I had guys who were staying sober, right? I developed a meditation. I thought I was doing this thing. I thought that that this was it, and you know, I had done all these things, right? I had gotten engaged, I had gone back to school, I'd become this straight A student. My entire life, all I've ever wanted was to be a physician. Since the moment I was I could conceive of what that was, I've wanted that for my entire life, and I was going down this path, and and everything was working. And you know, you turn around, and it's been 6 years, and everybody's proud of you, and you've started a CA group, and everybody looks up to you. You're the big book guy, right? You're the guy who knows all the answers, right? What I didn't understand that was that what came out of my experience at the Bridges of Hope was that I had a extremely mechanical understanding of the inner workings of this process. But I had absolutely no experience living it. See, when you called me and you wanted relationship advice, I would point you to a place in the book, and we would analyze it, and we could write it out, and we could write out different ways to do inventory. But I never had actually really anything of substance. And after 6 years, I'm sitting in my CA group. I call it my CA group because we started it, and we started it from the ground up. And I'm sitting in a room full of people that are laughing, and I feel completely alone. I feel like I'm so miserable because there's got to be more, but I don't know. I don't know how to find it. I meditate, and I'm just seemingly sitting there, right? I have absolutely no 10-step process whatsoever, no accountability, because what we've been taught is that, you know, once we get to a certain spot, we all walk shoulder on shoulder together through this process, right? Nobody ever held me accountable. I never sought out people to hold me accountable. And you know, throughout that process, I looked over. I had developed a friendship with a guy who had moved to Augusta, and he was my best friend in the room. He was like my road dog, right? He was the guy I talked shit with, and all the stuff that if you saw our text thread, we'd probably go to hell. He's that guy for me, right? And you know, he had been gone through a similar journey. And what happened when I was 7 years sober was that I started to watch him fade away from me. I started to watch him move beyond. I would call him, and he would say things to me about consciousness and in the present moment. And he would say things that I had heard these speakers talk about, like Don Pritz and Joe Hawk, that I thought sounded really cool, but he was having an experience with them. And I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. And I remember one day I was talking to Putz, and I said something to him, and I said, you know, like people who do what we do. And he said, well, what is it that we do? And he had me. Because I didn't have any idea what we do, right? I had a general idea of how to mechanically work the steps, but I had no experience living it. And you know, last year I humbled, I became humbled enough to ask that guy to take me through a set of steps, not really knowing what was going to happen, but knowing that if I was going to continue living, that I needed to do something different, and whatever he seemed to be doing was working, right? And I asked Satcher at like 2:30 in the morning one night while I was at work, I think. And he said yes. And he said he doesn't think he can have a problem holding me accountable, and he sure as hell doesn't. And you know, what happened was an absolutely amazing experience that took me to a place that I didn't even know existed in my recovery. You know, two of us sat down to start the work in March of last year, and with Satcher, and one of us is sitting here talking to y'all, and the other one ended up back in treatment, because he didn't want to write inventory, right? We sat down and we got so granular in their first step with these set of questions that we analyzed absolute my relationship with absolutely everything, and we talked about my conception and the conception of God that I have, and I understood that I had been operating with a conception of God that I had since I was my first year sober, right? And my life has changed in virtually every single way, but my conception of God is the same, right? And so it's no wonder that I'm in collision with absolutely everything around me and everybody around me. And I don't understand how to find my way out, because I'm trying to find my way out and my God's not big enough. We wrote inventory, and I started to look at these things in my life, that these defects of character, and the what it really is the conduct of my life. A deep analysis into how I interact with absolutely everybody around me and how my thought life dictates those actions. And we made a list, and you know, we had a beautiful experience in the ninth step where Satcher was going through the steps and I was going through the steps, and I'm like a week behind him, and we're making amends at the same time. And how beautiful to be able to do something like try to get some momentum in the steps so that I can pass my sponsor, right? How cool is that, right? And I think I got you. You know, I got to do things like sit down with my mother-in-law and talk to her about how I had fueled conflict between the relationship between her and her daughter, by taking the sides of both of them, and how my need to please everybody has created a rift between them. And I got to sit in her driveway and talk to her about that, and when I asked her what I could do to make that right, she looked at me and she said, just take care of my baby. And we'll get back to that in a minute, but you know, I had absolutely no experience with the 10th step. in this process, and I had virtually no accountability in my life. I had absolutely no idea the things that I was doing on a daily basis. This placed me in a position to be hurt, to be sore at everybody around me, and why I was having trouble navigating my life. And I got to experience true, real meditation and true connection. I did all of this, and I'm studying for the MCAT, and in my mind before we started the process, I was like, man, I can't add one more thing to my plate, and how could I not add one more thing to my plate, because it saved my life. And I got to do things like call Satcher and tell him I'm not making any progress. I'm not progressing on my practice tests. And he says, how's home? And I said, it's not good. And he said, well, why don't you focus your efforts there? And I listened to him. And if there's anything that I've done throughout this entire process, it's that I listen today. I listen, and I will follow directions today. Even if everything in my body doesn't want me to do it, I will follow directions. And I did. And would you know, I start scoring better on my practice tests, and I have this amazing experience where I go take this exam, and after all these experiences, and I'm just right in the middle of it, man. And I score in the top 10% country on it, and I had never even done that on a practice test before. And the process of awareness, and the process of conscious intent every day, striving for that. In August of last year, and moving into September, I remember I gave a talk at my home group, and I remember that it was the happiest that I'd ever been. Everything was great. At least I thought it was, and I got to share all these tremendous experiences about my life, and we were selling our house, and we were going to med school, and we were doing all these things, and our family was becoming united, and on October 23rd, my mother-in-law took a 38 and pressed it to her temple and pulled the trigger in front of my wife. And the same night, my dog got out and got hit by a car. And the same day, my father-in-law got admitted to the same hospital in the same operating room with necrotizing fasciitis in his foot, and had to get his leg amputated. And 3 days later, my grandmother had a stroke. What am I supposed to do with that? And I called Satcher when I was on the way to my mother-in-law's house, I don't even remember what he said. I just remember that he began walking me through what we were about to encounter and what I needed to be for my wife. Because I don't know how to be a husband. I don't know how to be a father. I don't know how to be a student. I don't know how to be any of these things. I need help. Right. And so everything that I had ever known up until that point came crashing down around me. I'm selling my house. I'm moving into the house that she shot herself in. I had to cancel the sale of my home. I don't know where my dog is. I didn't know he got hit. We looked for him for 2 weeks. We had to withdraw care on my mother-in-law on Wednesday of that week. And you know, I got a lot of phone calls during that period of time from a lot of people, and you know, two people were calling me, and that they were really the only two people I listened to, and it was Sasha and Brandon. And while everybody else was telling me that everything was going to be okay, Sasha was telling me that it's not going to be okay, and it wasn't. Putzer didn't tell me what to do. He just told stories to me. And I began to perceive the pain that I was feeling in a way that I didn't even know was possible, because what happened is that I had conceptualized all of the pain as if it was happening to me, because it's all about me. Everything has to happen to me, and it's not. I'm just along for the ride. And I don't know if that's real or what, but what it did was it gave me a little bit of time so that I could be there for my family during this period. And you know, I've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to talk about what I've been experiencing as a result of this process for the past 6 months, and kind of, you know, my experience making it through all of that. And I would love to be the speaker that would get up here and tell you that I buckled back down in the 11th step, and I re-engaged with this process, and it saved my life. And that's just not the truth, right? If you've never heard Mike B give the talk on Dark Night of the Soul, you should give it a listen, because my experience looked like meditation producing absolutely nothing, prayers meaning absolutely nothing, laying awake at 2 in the morning with a screaming 6-month-old and a shaking wife, asking God, why are you doing this to me? I've done absolutely everything that you asked. Been a good steward of you. Why is this happening to me? And I want to scream at him. And I can't even muster up the courage to face the people that can help me, but and I want somebody just to tell me what to do. And the truth is that sometimes there's absolutely nothing to do. Just be still. Just be still and know that I am. I can tell you today that I don't really know, you know, where I am along in that process. I do know that, you know, navigating this process has tested my marriage to the absolute brink. It's tested my resolve for my dreams and my goals, my ambitions as a father, as a student, for a career. It's tested absolutely everything. But the only thing that's remained steadfast is when somebody gives me a direction, I do it. You know, the process of healing has been hard in my house, and you know, I've got a wife who experienced one of the most traumatic things, and I'm a bad communicator at baseline, right? And And through the process of this program, I get to do amazing things today, like listen to my sponsor say, "Well, you're not listening to me, so go to therapy now." And I get to go to therapy with my wife. And we were sitting in therapy on Monday, and we were talking to the lady, and I looked up at the wall, and there's this sign, and it says, "Be still and know that I am God." And so sometimes that's about all I've got. And that's okay. Because I know that I will continue down this path, and not a single time throughout this process has my sobriety ever been in jeopardy. Not once. The pain that I've experienced is not even the what I experienced when I was out running the streets was does not even compare to the things that we've gone through in the past 6 months. And so what I realized in this process is that, I ask God to recreate my life. It doesn't mean that I always have to love how he does it. But I will continue to seek. I will continue to gain a deeper understanding and consciousness, and I will continue down this path. And so, guys, I think that's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you, Chasten. That was, whew. Yeah, that was awesome.